Welcome back. Hopefully you guys enjoyed a little bit of food. I know we certainly did. For those of you just tuning in, where have you been? In any event, this is the Web API Design Jumpstart alongside Jeremy Lichtness. I am merely Christopher Harrison. Now, up until now, we've really been just taking a look at how to structure and build up our Web API. And we just finished off a module where we took a look at how to handle routing and started to look at how to, you know, pass data in and send data back out. And we're obviously going to continue down that path, but for those of you who were here about an hour or so ago, you may remember that, well, again, this is the joy of doing live demos. We had a demo go slightly sideways. We have this demo working. So what we'd like to do is actually start with that demo and then spin forward into doing both validation and error handling, which I think is sort of a perfect segue. So Jeremy, what went sideways on us? What went wrong?
Oh, well,
I'm not blaming you personally.
It's actually a forest and trees syndrome, right? I was couldn't see the forest for the trees. So I was in this demo looking at this thing that I set up. I wrote the code. Yeah. I tested. But it gets into something we're going to talk about a little bit later, which is parameter binding. So there's a good tie-in to the last module and an upcoming module. And when I talk about the last module, the tie-in that I'm going to show is if we look at this Web API config, you can see there's no ID off of the controller. So I did not set a template based on sending in a value to a collection. So what happened was when I was running this, I was trying to bring in this test message, and not that I want to replay the pain too much, but I was in here, and I'm just stealing the URL. And so I did this post to API. I believe it was responses is the controller.
Yep.
So we did this responses, and then I tried to change it to a post.
Yep.
And said, hey, let's put a message called test, and I sent that in, and I got this HTTP method post.
Right.
Well, two things are at work here. One is that template didn't allow for an ID, and two is the way parameter binding works. It was actually looking for something more like this. So let me remove that and send that. And you can see it bounces test back.
Okay. And so it's worth highlighting that you are, in fact, doing post. And the problem, of course, and like you mentioned, or I think you mentioned, is that because of the fact that string is a simple type, I always find it hard to think of string as a simple type because in .NET it's a reference type. So that just always changes my brain. It just requires an extra cycle. But in any event, because of the fact that string is considered a simple type, it's expecting that on the query string, whereas our complex types are going to be sent via post inside the header information.
Right.
Okay.
And there's a lot of flexibility and control you have over that we'll cover in a later module. But just to close this one out, what we were looking to do is, okay, so here's a post, and because it's simple, it goes in the query string, we get message back. So I'm going to take this accept, do application JSON. It should do pretty much the exact same thing, which you can see it did.
Yep.
Then I'm going to add this special HAL plus JSON and send that. Or is it JSON plus HAL?
I think
it's
it was
gonna be
XML.
Something.
I think it was HAL plus XML.
All right, we're gonna find a combination that works. It's
now,
the last thing we do.
It is worth noting.
It's accept.
Yeah,
I'm gonna cut it.
Yeah, try
from
real
the code.
Quick. Yeah, but it is worth highlighting that when you're building this up, you can actually choose whatever you want as your you can actually choose whatever you want your media type to be. So if you just want to call it Wibble, you could absolutely do that. Now, obviously, you have to document it so that way people kind of know what it is that you're going to be sending back down. But you can make that be whatever it is that that you want there.
Okay, so let me call out this operator error. I'm trying to put a form data that has the accept value instead of up here in the header.
Okay, there we go.
So that was the second one. So pretty much every combination of demonstrating how to use Postman is included in this particular demo. So we're going to send that. And look at that. So what we get back is the message with test in it, but we also get these links with these hrefs. And I did that purposefully on the server by looking at that media type and sending a different request type based on what I got. So, whew, we're done with that one.
Yeah, it worked.
We're moving on. It worked.
Yes, that's all that matters. All right. Now, this is, again, sort of a perfect segue, that there's really two little issues that I'm seeing. Number one is obviously, you know, how do we let the client know that something went wrong and give them a little bit of information along those lines? But also, two, and string is a perfect example of this, that if I say that you can send in a string, you can really almost send in whatever it is that you might possibly want. And that's obviously a problem, because if you're sending us malformed data, maybe just because you made a mistake or because of the fact that you're trying to hack our system, we need to make sure that we're not going to let that happen. So we need to talk about validation. We need to talk about error handling. Hey, Jeremy, what's the title of this module?
It happens to be Validation and Error Handling.
Hey, all right.
So that's going to be perfect. And what we're going to dive into is, first I'm going to recap those status codes that I talked about, uh-huh, which are the RESTful way of talking to the world. Then I'm going to go into model validation. And I love this because, for me, it's the biggest argument to use Web API as opposed to some alternate technologies to stand up your REST endpoints. And I'll get into why that is. I'm going to talk about built-in helpers that are part of Web API. It's another thing that makes it a lot easier. You've seen them already. And then we'll get into exception filters and global exception handling. So the very first thing I want to step into is status codes, which are really the language of HTTP.
Yep.
I mean, this is the standard way to communicate what's happening. And we talked about that in a previous module. If I do a delete and the resource isn't there, what's the right way to manage it? So here on your screen are some of the most common status codes that you'll deal with. It's by no means all of them.
No.
And you can enumerate them through the system and research. But these are the ones you're going to be dealing with quite a bit. So the 200 is things are great. And typically, mm-hmm, you're returning something back, although you don't have to. Usually, if you're saying things are great and you have nothing to show for it, mm-hmm, you're going to use the 204.
Okay.
So 204 is a things are great, I just have nothing to show you.
Right.
Then we've got a 201, which is created. And that created can do a number of things. I might return back the item,
okay,
that you just created. Or I might even just in the header return a location so you can navigate to the item. So I'm saying, hey, it's created, but I'm not going to give you the item because you already know it. You posted it to me. If you want to navigate to it, here's the location. Then
Perfect.
We've got a bad request. That's going to tie
bad
into
request.
Exactly. That's going to tie into how we actually look at data and validation, what's going on inside the payload. We've got an unauthorized, which in our security module, we'll tackle that one.
Yep, next module.
And a forbidden. So unauthorized means you haven't authenticated yet, mm-hmm, or you can't get to the resource at all. Forbidden means, yes, we know who you are, but we're still not going to let you get in. You haven't,
okay,
been given the permission. So that's the nuance.
No soup for you, 1 year.
Exactly.
Okay.
And then we've got not found, which, yep, is the easiest one to describe because it means not found.
Not found.
Exactly.
Not
literally
found. And that was the error code that you used on the delete, where if we couldn't find it based on the ID, you returned back a 404. And we discussed that a fair amount this morning. I don't think,
sure,
we need to rehash that.
Nope. Let's jump into actually using these status codes for something meaningful.
Okay, perfect.
And the very first thing I'm going to talk about is model validation. And this is a very powerful capability of Web API. And what this allows you to do is use something that's very mature with the .NET framework. If you've done Entity Framework, you're familiar with this. It, uh-huh, plays into WCF, forms, you name it. It's this data annotations library. So it's a part of the framework, and it allows you to annotate your classes and indicate different types, ranges, and validations, such as, you know, if this is a credit card, if it should be an email address, if it should fall within a range. There's phone number, required URL. Credit card's one I would have loved to have, you know, 6 or 7 years ago when I was building my own credit,
oh, yeah,
card systems,
yep,
and trying to figure out the perfect regular expression that actually not only validated the digits but mapped it to the card. But
yeah,
it's part of the framework now, which is exciting.
And you know, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt there, but one of the very cool things about those data annotations is that they're not just for Web API and they're not just for validation here, that MVC uses this as well for both validation as well as creating the different types of HTML controls. So, for example, if you flag something as email, then what will wind up happening is MVC, when you say generate the editor, will actually generate an email text box with HTML5. And I would also go one step further that a lot of these, not all of them, but a lot of these different validation options like required for string or string length are also used in turn by Entity Framework. So if you're not working with a very complex project and you're not setting up a view model, then that model that you're creating, you decorate it with these attributes and then you can use it with Entity Framework, you can use it with MVC, you can use it with Web API, or I should say it's going to be used by each of those platforms. So you're sending it once, and then across the board, those are now going to work. So this is not specific to just Web API.
Right. And the beautiful thing about this is one of the challenges traditionally we have is this duplication of validation, right? So we've got it on the server, then we have to do it again on the client. And this is one way to keep it in one place, describe exactly what validations you're having, and then it's ubiquitous throughout the system. Your API calls themselves can bring these validations back, and I'll show you how that's done. Mm-hmm. And there's libraries, too, that enable bringing some of those data annotations to the client side and doing client side validations based on them.
Yep.
So it's a very powerful and flexible way to do that. So I'm continuing on data annotations because beyond what you get outside of the box, we've got custom validations. We've got this concept of model state that I'll show you, but that basically surfaces exactly what's going on within your Web API method. You can add your own errors. So if you've got something that you want to check on the server side, you can do that. And you get this really nice model state is valid that you can look at and say, you know, based on my rules that I've set, is it good or is it not?
And that's exactly what we have in MVC as well. So that little model state, it's the exact same thing. Adding in the errors, it's the exact same thing. So if you've done MVC, you're already familiar with this.
Right. And the beautiful thing about model state is that it's serializable. So you can take that and send it to the client, and then you have a standard way of communicating validation errors that I'm going to show you. And with that, I'm going to jump into my validation demo. And what we'll do is jump into validation error demos. And in the Q&A, I know this has been posted a few times. There's a link so that you can follow along if you like or download this code later on and look at that.
You're going to make me dig that up. There we go.
I've seen it in there a few times. I'll post it now. So I think you're good. So in this model validation, we've got a user's controller. And before I run this, I want to show you what a user looks like. So this is a user.
You look like a user. Right.
Sorry, you're a user. I'm a user. Oh, okay. And here's how we're represented in code.
Okay. All right. So we've got an ID, a name, and an age.
Right. I feel like there's a little more to me than that. But for purposes of this demo, we're going to leave it there. So this is really something that we're not going to use too much in our Web API because this is more a tip to something like Entity Framework. Hey, what's the unique key for this item?
It is worth noting, forgive me, we just did an Entity Framework last week, so
awesome.
I have to mention this. But if you use ID, the key attribute becomes superfluous. Some people do like having it just because it makes it very clear, hey, this is the key. But if you use ID or if you use class name ID, then it will automatically become the primary key. And it will also automatically become an identity or an auto count inside the database as well behind the scenes. So, which is typically what you want with your primary key. Not always, but typically.
Sure. Yeah. A little bit of that convention
magic
that goes on.
Yep.
So what we've got on name is we're just setting it to required. I could put more complex rules around it, but for this demo, I'm going to keep it there. Mm-hmm. And then in age, I'm assuming, and this is no offense to anyone who might be 123, but for this demo, I'm setting the range between 1 and 120.
Okay. For anybody who's 123, you look great. I just want you to know that. You look great.
All right. So let's fire this up, and then we'll look at the code behind it so you can see how these work. And again, our favorite page, the forbidden
page. You're forbidden.
And then I'm going to clean up my Postman, set this in. And what we've got is an API users, and we can validate that in our source because we've got a user's controller, so I'm just using convention in this case. And we've got a post for the user. So what's important for me to remember when I construct this is just that there's an ID, a name, and an age. So when we come to Postman, excuse me, let's change this to a post, and I'm going to use this form URL encoded. And look at this, it's remembering that I had something there for this API.
That's awfully
convenient. Fred, who's 121. What I'm going to do is I'll go ahead and send that. And immediately I get this message back that says the request is invalid. Then I have a model state property off of this is a root object in JavaScript. So there's a message and a model state. Within that, it gives me this new user.age, and the field age must be between 1 and 120.
Okay.
So what's really nice about that, we'll take a step back. I'm not going to build this framework live before your eyes. It'd be exciting if I did, but we've got a lot to cover.
Yep.
But you can build a JavaScript framework that reads these standard messages and uses them to highlight and set classes on the client side. So you can indicate, boom, this is where the error is, and this is where I show their message.
Yeah, actually, somebody just asked about like using Angular, using Kendo UI. You know, how do we start to display all those error messages? And you could just go in and read the JSON just like that. I would also mention, if you go back to that screen real quick, that little error message, the field age must be between 1 and 120, that's automatically generated by that attribute. And if you want, you can actually add in an additional property called error message. So if you wanted to customize that error message, you can do that. And you didn't actually do anything fancy there to return back that error message. It was basically just generated as part of the validation there.
I'm going to show the magic for that in a second. What I want to do is change Fred with Jeremy, and I'll put my age as 39, and we'll send that out. Ah, and there we've got a custom error.
Don't lie about Jeremy's
age. Basically said, don't lie about my age. So I just wanted to point out that you can have custom validation. So if I'm a little more honest about it, and I send it this way, then I get a nice new created.
Yep, perfect.
Message back. Now, the other thing is, this is a 200 okay.
Yep.
And we've got a nice prompt here, and Postman tells us what to expect. When I go back to my 39, the status code is a bad request. So I'm doing two things. I'm informing the client that something went wrong.
Yep.
And that's the status code. But then I can return content even on a bad request. Any status code, you can associate content with it. So that's my standard error payload that then the client can pick up and run with.
Right. And, you know, somebody had asked about, you know, why don't you just simply send out a status message rather than sending down, you know, a 404 or 400 message. And the main reason is that on the client, they're expecting that if something went wrong, they're expecting a 400. And that's going to throw an exception, as it were. I'm sort of oversimplifying there. But that's basically what it's going to wind up doing. Whereas if you just simply send that down inside of a 200, it's something that can be very easily missed. It's something that can be very easily skipped over, glossed over. So by sending down that 400, you're making sure that the client knows, hey, we had a problem here. You need to address this.
Right. And it's also going to the idea of, are your APIs being consumed internally by your own apps or externally? If they're external, the more standardized you can make it, and external clients know what a 400 is, know what a 404 is, much easier than if you're setting up your own codes and within your own app, you know, hey, I'm just going to always look here. So what, for example, we like to do in a lot of our projects that we build is create a base class that grabs that 400 bad request, knows the standard way this model state comes back, and parses and gives a nice package to then the page that I'm writing with so that it wires up the form automatically.
Yeah.
And then it saves keystrokes and makes it easier on developers.
Absolutely. And I want to answer a question that's been asked by both actually, Anthony, it was just two separate questions about from body, from URI, and why we're not using it. Now, from body means that it's going to be in the body, maybe via a post. From URI means that it's going to be part of the query string. That's what those two little attributes mean. And you can use them when you define your parameters in your model binding, which is something we're going to talk a little bit more about in Module 6. But the main thing that both from body and from URI MRI allow you to do is not only identify where you're expecting the data from, but it also gives you the opportunity to limit the data that you're going to be getting back. So for example, on a new item being created, I'm looking for the name, I'm looking for the age, I'm not looking for the ID because I'm going to generate that ID. So what I can do when I set this up is I can say, hey, look, I only want two properties. I only want the name. I only want the age. I don't want the ID. So I can tell it to fail, or I can tell it to just simply ignore the ID if it's being passed in. And there's a couple of different reasons to do that, the biggest of which is security, that with a particular type of object, with a web API in MVC, it's automatically going to try and bind everything up. So if you have on an object a parameter called or a property called ID, and somebody sends that up inside of a text box or inside of a web API call, ASP.NET automatically wants to bind it because that's what it thinks it's supposed to do. Unfortunately, if I don't actually want that, it's now going to bind up, which can then start causing problems. So the other advantage to using that from body and from URI is not just, hey, where do we want to read this data from? But it's also, this is the data that I want and nothing else. Now, the reason that Jeremy doesn't have it in there was simply because, hey, we're just looking for a demo code here, and it's just simple to go in and write it. And honestly, when I go in and I do my demos, I basically never throw in from body from URI. Is it a best practice? Should you use it? Yes, but it's one of those when you're trying to do demos, you're just looking for the least amount of code as possible there.
Sure.
Yep.
And another thing I wanted to do too was we're going to cover those very explicitly in parameter binding.
Yep.
And so there's a set of rules that are followed by convention, sort of like when we talked about actions on routers. And based on those rules, I can make some assumptions, but we'll get into how to turn those assumptions over and even be more explicit about it. So that was a great question, by the way. So here's the anatomy.
Gold star.
Here's the anatomy of my new user post. And what I wanted to cover is the first thing I'm checking is if I even get a new user. And if I don't, I just return bad request. And this is a helper, and we're going to get into helpers in the next section, so just bear with me on that one.
Okay.
The next thing
bad
I'm doing,
request.
Yeah, exactly, bad request. So once I get down here, I know, okay, I've got a new user. So the next thing I'm going to do is if the name is Jeremy and the age is not 40, this is how I add a custom error to the model state, add model error. So I might have another business object that does this, or I might do it writing code. You know, there's a couple different approaches. I'm doing it here to illustrate. Now notice I'm not checking age. I'm not checking if the name exists. My next step is just to say, is the model state valid? So it just automatically took that new user and set the model state for me. I may have set it to invalid with this custom error, but even if the name or the age was missing, this is going to become false. And so I return a bad request, and what I'm returning as the content is the model state.
Okay.
And that's where we saw this age is off or the name is required, et cetera.
And so you did that very simply, that you didn't actually, and you can do this, you can create your own custom validation attributes, but you didn't actually do that in this case, that you just simply, a little bit of code, I'm just going to do a real quick check, make sure that everything looks good.
Right.
And just to sort of spin that forward, you know, there are going to be times when an attribute isn't going to work, that maybe I need to bounce it off the database first, that maybe there's a trigger or something like that that runs on the database, and now it comes back and says, hey, we had a problem here. You can then very easily slide in, hey, now we've got this additional model error. And you want to use those model errors to centralize all of the errors and then send all of that back.
Right.
Yep.
And that's there's some validation libraries, too, that you can apply. And this is an easy way to call out to the validation library and use that to spin up theirs as well.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's not valid, I return a bad request with the model state. Otherwise, I'm just setting a dummy ID. Normally, I would insert it into the database, get the real ID,
right.
And then I'm returning an okay with that user.
Okay.
So this is it, and the entire reason why this model state is set to invalid is because of those data annotations. So it automatically understood that, hey, I had to serialize a new user from this request. So when I do that, oh, look, there's data annotations.
Yep.
Let me run through those and wire up my model state for you. So it makes it incredibly easy to deal with validations.
And one little thing that's worth highlighting real quick, if I can just break out my soapbox for about 30 seconds here, is when you're doing validation, and I always like to mention this, look for good values. Don't look for bad values. Make sure that whatever has been provided is inside of that good range. If it's not inside that good range, it's bad, reject it at that point. Because the problem with looking for bad values is the list of bad values is infinitely longer than the list of good values. Look for good. If it's not inside the good, it must be bad. And then you can go ahead and throw your exception or you know return back your bad request. At that point.
So the only thing I'll add is I agree.
Yes. Thank
Good
you.
Advice.
Thank you.
Which is really adding nothing. So let's talk about these helpers that I've been using. Once we have the validations and we're doing the validations the right way, we can use these helpers to return information and not, as I say, reinvent the wheel. What do I mean by that? Well, we've got these status codes and there's several ways that we can return status codes. We can actually spin up a response result and we can explicitly set the status code. We can serialize the object into the request, mm-hmm. but these helpers take the really common cases and make it dead simple, right? So I didn't have to serialize the model and say put the model in the response and then set the status code to 404. I just returned the code that simply said bad request or bad request with a model state inside of it. And that's all I needed to do to set both the status and serialize something to the stream. Likewise, when I returned my OK and got my 200 OK, I just passed the new user mm-hmm. and let it serialize directly. So we've got things like conflicts, created at route, internal server error. All of these are helpers that are built in when those methods derive from the web API controller that we can use to return that HTTP result. And so let me just give you a quick demo where I'm going to use a controller in a very non-conventional way. So I've got this helpers controller. Let me come back to Postman so we can see what's going on behind the scenes.
No. Sorry, Postman. All right, that was a stretch
Me. That's all you get from me is just, All right, so we're going to go to helpers and test equals, not that. Test equals one, and we're going to send that.
Okay.
Okay, so we've got this null value for parameter test. So that's an issue with actually the serialization of the parameter value. So that's what the controller itself gave. But notice it's still responding in a nice formatted JSON object.
Right.
Now, I probably want to capture that, and that's where we'll go into exception handling and filtering. It'll be a nice segue into the next
section. I like it. Yep.
But let's actually give this a parameter that it can deal with. So when I set test equals one, I got no content, and I got this 409 conflict.
Okay.
So there's some conflict in the request. I'm totally making this up, but demonstrating how these helpers work, and we'll look at the code in a second. So let's change this to a two, send that in. Now I got 201 created with some content.
Okay.
And that's my misspelled daughter's name, Lizzie, who's 15. Sorry, Lizzie, I forgot the I, but it's all good. We'll do a test of three, and this time I get a 201 created as well. But if I look in the headers, you're going to notice I have this location in the header that is giving me a hypothetical endpoint from the API.
So that's how you could load up the object if you wanted to, just by...
Exactly.
Okay.
Right, so if I took it back to two and fired the same result, that location header is API bogus because I didn't load it up explicitly. And you'll see what this means in the code.
So you're just showing us the client side.
Exactly. So we'll go to four, and now I've got an exception. We'll go to five, and I've got a not found. We'll go to six, and I've got a 200 OK with no content. We'll go to seven, and I think I go up to nine, right? So this was actually trying to redirect and didn't find something. Eight is multiple choice, and then nine is bad request, 400.
Bad request.
Okay, what does it all mean? If we look at our helper's controller, I'm getting this parameter test, which because it's an integer, then Web API will automatically take the value passed in and throw that parser error if it doesn't match. So that's why when I had null, that came back. Mm-hmm. I'm creating my user object. I'm creating a URI, and these are just to use later on. So based on what I passed in, if I passed a 1, I just use this conflict helper. If I passed a 2, I use this created. And here's what's interesting with created. It gives me this lovely convention. I can either just pass the user, mm-hmm. and I'll get a 201 created with the user.
The object that was created.
Right. But if I pass a URI, it's going to automatically set the location header for me.
Okay.
So it just takes, I don't have to worry about it. I don't even have to memorize what the status code is. I also have created at route. What created at route does is it lets me specify a route. So this name is going to match what we have here in our web API configuration. It's that route.
Oh, okay. So you can call specifically to the route that you want.
Exactly.
Okay.
So, and then I can give it the parameters for the route, and mm-hmm. it will wire up that route and return it in the location.
So the route was looking for ID, and it will automatically drop ID where it should be in that URL.
Correct. And this I would recommend over this, and here's why. This involves creating a URI, and you can use URI helpers, etc. But let's say for now it's API bogus, and we move it, mm-hmm. or we use the controller in another project and it changes.
Yep.
This will always map to the correct route because it's assuming the current controller. This will be hard-coded and won't be as portable. It's
right.
not going to travel with you. So then we've got an internal server error. You can send it actually empty. You can send a message or you can throw an exception with inside that. Mm-hmm. We've got our not found. We've got our OK, which can also take a message. We've even got a redirect to a new URI. And what this is going to do is it'll actually try to reissue that API to the new URI that I have there.
Okay.
But because I sent it to a bogus API, we got the error back that it couldn't find it. Mm-hmm. Here's a way that any status code we want to send, if, hey, the helpers aren't working for us, we just need a special status code like ambiguous, we can pass it that way. And then we've got bad request, which we already saw.
Okay, so just kind of real quick here. Can we actually kick back to the code? Sorry about that. So on the status code, so if there isn't a helper that's available, I can just send down the specific status code that that I want. And if we scroll up real quick, if we just kind of run through this, so a conflict, I might return that back of, let's say somebody tries to create a user account and it matched an email that was already in the database. I might return that back with a conflict.
Sure.
Created at route would be, hey, look, this succeeded. That's the one that we probably want to use. Internal server error means that, hey, we tried something. Maybe we tried to update our database and the connection failed. So we just want to let you know, hey, that didn't work. Our not found would be obviously a get request or maybe an update or a delete request where you passed in the ID. We couldn't find it. Okay simply means, hey, look, we did something. Maybe we deleted the item and we don't have anything to return back, so we just simply send that back to you. And then obviously the redirect is going to be used on those situations where maybe we've updated the address and you used to be able to use this URI, but now I just need to send you somewhere else. And that seems to me like that could also be, to a certain extent, helpful for future-proofing this. So that way, if I do change the URL, that now going forward, that I could reroute them to the new URL without them necessarily having to update all of their code. Did I run through all of that?
That you ran through it.
All right.
Exactly it. This pattern is really the pattern that I follow.
Okay.
90%, not the switching and having a bunch of cases.
Right.
But what you saw with this user's controller where I'm returning an IHTTP action result.
Yep.
I'm using route attributes. I didn't do it here because it's a simple demo, but I'm using route attributes. And then I'm using these helpers to control exactly what the flow is. And I mean, I don't know about you, but when I look at this code, it's pretty easy to me to see what's going on.
Right.
This is sending a bad request.
Yep.
It's not ambiguous. Whereas if I said return new status code,
yep.
404 or whatever, you know, it's not quite as obvious in the code. So
this
also makes it more readable and maintainable.
Absolutely.
In my opinion.
Yeah. And if you're anything like me, and I know I am, whenever I go back to my code later on, I want to make sure that it's as clean as possible. Because, I mean, granted, yes, you know, other people are going to come along and look at it. But I know for me that it's just, it's so often, so frequent that I'll write a block of code, I'll have to go back to it 2 months later, and I'm trying to remember what in the world I did. So having all of those different types of things nice and clear makes it that much easier. And a lot of people asked kind of earlier on about decorating with things like HTTP GET, POST, DELETE, etc., whether or not that's actually required. I know for me personally, I always put that in there. And the reason for that is, again, I like that to be nice and clear so that way I know exactly what it is that that I'm looking at. So that's just me.
Yeah, I tend to navigate towards attributes over conventions myself.
Yeah, exactly.
Even if they are redundant for the convention, just because it's so explicit.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. Cool.
All right. Well, the next thing I want to talk about is within there we had this internal server error.
Yep.
And I showed the example where it wasn't able to serialize a parameter because that parameter wasn't in the right format, so just threw an exception. So how do we handle that when the exception is the rule? We'll go into exception filters, right?
I see what you did there.
Yeah, I was pretty proud of it myself. But so exception filters have a few attributes that make them very nice for designing your APIs. First thing is they're reusable. So you can take one filter and you can use it throughout your application. In fact, you can apply these filters at action controller global levels. So you can say, I'm always using this filter, or maybe this filter only makes sense for this particular action. So you've got that fine-grained control. Now, these have less access to the context and the content. What I mean by that is when you're inside an action method, you have this full request and response stack. You don't have as much access, and you'll see what I mean when we write the filter, but it's purposeful because it's meant to be sort of at a high level. We're not at the validation error level, we're at an exception was actually thrown. So we'll talk about that. An exception is still thrown when the debugger is on. So even if you have a filter, it doesn't just silently capture this in debug mode. It will throw the exception and then pick it up and filter it.
Okay.
So you derive it from the exception filter attribute. I'm going to show you how to do that. Override on exception. And you can set the response to something new. So as a part of that filter, you can change what the response is. So these are all the attributes of an exception filter. Let's take a look at, in code, how that's implemented. So I'm going to come back to this project and set this as my startup after I stopped the previous one. So we'll create this startup project, and you can see in our controllers this time, we've got a local and a controller exception. So I'm going to start with this local, and I'm using my route prefix API local, I've got not implemented, da-da-da-da-da. Let's just take a look at it. Exactly. Let's take a look at it, and then we'll come back.
Yep.
So we'll come into, I'm not going to even say the name because you'll start singing again.
Yeah. I promise not to sing again.
All right. So we've got local. Let's start with not implemented. Local, not implemented.
I think you called it local exceptions, or did you change the default route?
I changed the default route. So I've got a route prefix of API local and then not implemented.
Yep, perfect.
Okay, so if I fire this one off, we get an exception in the debugger.
So it still throws the exception.
It's still throwing it, but I also haven't trapped it at all. So if I continue now, what you're going to get is, interestingly enough, a payment required. Where on earth did that come from?
Mm-hmm.
We will look at that in a second.
Payment required. All righty.
Okay. So, but we'll circle around. There is a method to this madness. So that's the API local not implemented. So now let's look at the not implemented explicit.
Pay me or else. And, you know, while he's doing this in the background, you'll notice that not implemented WAC explicit. Somebody had asked in the Q&A about, you know, how do you go in and build up those full types of URIs, URLs. And that is something that we talked about in the prior module, but it's just by doing that. It's by going in and setting up those types of routes.
Right.
Yep.
Exactly. So what I've done here is you would just take API local. That's my route prefix on the controller. And then you'd add not implemented explicit. That's my route on the action. that leads with API local, not implemented explicit. And we just got this message not implemented. So this is me explicitly returning a bad request. So nothing really magic there. This one will use the filter. So I've got this not implemented filter. So we'll say not implemented filter here.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so I'm going to change it from explicit to filter. Send that. And again, we get this exception here. We'll continue there. And then the filter action isn't implemented either. And 501 because the filter caught it. So this is better than the 402 payment, right? That's still a mystery hanging out there that we'll resolve. But we got this 501.
Send your checks too.
Right, exactly. If there's an exception, we want you to pay us. No. And then we've got this not implemented. So there was not implemented explicit and not implemented exception. So let's see what that looks like. So we do exception, and we are going to blow up. We'll continue. And again, we're back to payment required. So it's a mystery. So here's what happened behind the scenes, and then I'll show it on another controller.
Mm-hmm.
What I've done is under my filters, I've got this not implemented filter. So in this not implemented filter, I've got on exception, and that's where I get this context that's specific to the action. Okay, so that comes into the filter. If it's a not implemented exception, that's where I'm changing the message, and I'm returning this because the filter caught it.
Okay.
So that's where you saw when I applied the filter, we got the 501.
Right. And
that said,
we had
because
that little
the filter
custom
caught
message.
It. Yeah. Exactly. So that's what's happening here. Otherwise, I'm just following through and saying, whatever you normally do, do that.
Okay.
Okay, so that's the filter that I put specifically on these actions. Not implemented filter here, not implemented filter here. What I've also got, if you look here, is this logging filter. And that logging filter does something else that we'll loop around with for the global exception handling. But then I've got a text handler and a text logger. So loggers, filters, exceptions, where mm-hmm. does it all come together? Well, if I look at this text handler, notice that it does a handle on the exception and returns this payment required.
So it wasn't just simply that something went wrong and a default status happened to be payment required. You explicitly set up a filter. It caught the exception and said, okay, well, this is the message code that we're now going to send down. So that was all you're doing. That wasn't anything that was default by web API.
Right.
Okay.
That's correct.
All right. So you're the one that's demanding payment.
I'm the one that's demanding payment.
All right.
So if we look at this local exceptions controller, what happened was there's no attribute on the controller.
Okay.
There's no attribute on these two, but they were still caught by that handler that
yep.
did the payment required. And then we've got the not implemented, so that picked up this exception and returned that 501 message.
So you have filters for those last two that were specific to just those last two. On the first one, it actually caught because they match, not implemented.
Right.
But on that last one, you just threw generic exception. That obviously doesn't match, and that's why it bubbled back to that default. And
that's
you're going to show us how you set up that default.
I am.
Okay.
And then I've got a controller exceptions that we don't have to walk through because it's going to do the same thing. But I'm just showing I can apply not implemented at the controller level.
Yep.
And then what will happen is if I do, well, actually, I'll just show you this one so we can show that. So instead of local, I called it API controller. And then it's not implemented is the route. And as you can see, there's not a filter on this action, but there is a filter on the controller. And so when I fire this action, I'm going to get the, I did controller. No, we want controller not implemented. So we'll send that. We get the exception. It throws. Then it passes through the filter. And because the filter caught it.
Okay.
So now this filter is going to capture everything mm-hmm. on the controller. So let me pop back over to my slides because you saw something else happen there. And that was the payment required.
Yeah, that payment required was global. So the other two, we had an attribute. We had an attribute on the controller, which was what you just demoed. We had an attribute on specific actions, which we saw earlier. But that payment required, that was in this odd nebulous space. I didn't see that anywhere on the last two screens.
Right.
Okay.
So we're going to jump into that because what will happen is with these filters, you can see that there may be a certain type of exception you want to do something special with all of the time.
Right.
And so instead of having to go through every single controller and every action and attribute it, we need a global way to tackle these within our application. So what I want to show you is how these global exception handlers work. Now, they're different than filters, and I'm going to explain that in a second. So some of the tricky areas for errors are controller constructors. So let's say Web API is going through your route, and it's trying to figure out a controller. And for some reason, you have, say, some dependency that doesn't exist, and the controller blows up. Mm-hmm. Well, you can't catch that on a controller attribute because it can't even create the controller in the first place.
Right.
Right? So we have to have some way to deal with that. We've got message handlers that may be outside of the pipeline. Mm-hmm. We've got routing. What if the route itself fails? In the case where you have two get methods and the route fails, again, you can't put a filter on that action because it's never calling the action.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, it didn't actually get there.
So what's different about these global exception handlers is you don't have as much of a context. And by context, I mean when you get that action context for the filter, you know the controller and the action that you're dealing with.
Yep.
That's a context because it's already routed and mapped. With the global errors, you don't necessarily have that context because it might have blown up farther up in the pipeline.
So, you know, it's about the only thing that I remember from physics. Well, a body in motion tends to stay in motion, body at rest tends to stay at rest. But the other big thing that I always remember is if a tree falls in a forest, nothing around to hear it, does it make a sound? The answer to that question is no, because all that it's doing is compressing airwaves. If there's nothing around to interpret it, it's not actually sound.
Right.
So bring that back into... Trust me, I'm going to get there.
Okay.
Bringing that back into our filters, in order for the filters to actually work, we need to have built up that controller. We need something to actually be there. Otherwise, we're just going to have this compression of airwaves over here. We haven't actually built our listening device because we tried to construct the controller, which is where our listening device was. We failed before that. No listening device. As a result, no sound. As a result, it's not going to actually catch that exception. You thought I wasn't going to be able to bring that back, did you?
No, that was beautiful. I couldn't have said it better myself. Couldn't have said it better myself.
And I would also close all of that by saying real simply that when you're talking about exception handling, 9 times out of 10, what are you trying to do? You're trying to do 2 things. You're trying to log this somewhere, and you're just trying to exit gracefully. So, you know, it's not going to be very often. It happens, but it's not going to be very often where you're looking for something specific to happen for a particular type of error. That typically, it's just going to be, you know what, we had a problem. Let's return back their status code. Let's go ahead and log this and be done with it. And that's exactly where that global handler comes into play, because then we can just build all of that into there.
Right.
Yep.
Exactly.
Perfect.
So there's 2 things you can do at a global level, and this was largely requested in previous versions of Web API. It's finally there.
Excellent.
And your 2 strategies are, one is the concept of a logger. And so for global exception handling, I can grab this logger and do something interesting with it.
Okay. It's log. Okay. It's log. It's such a wonderful toy.
That's right. It's log. Yep. It's long. It's round. It's log. Yeah, something like that. But I remember that. Be interesting to see if anyone else does. And
it's
so
heavy, it's round, it's wood. I think that's
big, it's heavy,
it's wood. Wood. Yay!
Perfect.
There we go. We got there.
But coming back to the logging handler. No, so this is a pipeline. So you can have multiple ones to plug into that, which you want with logging, because you may have a third party, you may write your own. So you want to be able to register one to many.
Yep, absolutely.
So then there's also an exception handler. This is your true global last resort handler. You can only have one. So this is not a pipeline or a filter. How you deal with this is how that error is handled, period, point blank, across the application.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want more fine-grained control, you can go back to the filter method. And you can globally add filters, and we're going to see all of that. So let me just drop into the code base, because we've already seen the behaviors. What you hadn't seen as much of is if I do my Control-Alt-O and open the debug window. I'm going to open. Yeah, okay. So from the global logger, the method or operation is not implemented. Exception filter controllers, da-da-da. So you can see I've got these explicit messages.
So it did actually write all of that out.
Right,
okay.
Into my debug console.
Yep.
So the way I did that is, remember, so I've got a logging filter. And this logging filter is just writing basically the controller, because remember I said in the filters, you have context. Mm-hmm. So you know the controller, you know this, that, and the other. So this actually has a context, and I'll go ahead and zoom in for that. But it knows that exception filter controllers, local exception, et cetera. So I can grab that context off of it, and that's what I'm writing here.
Yep.
So we had not implemented, and we had logging. Then over here in exception handling, we have the text logger. So what the text logger does is it writes from the global logger and just grabs that message off of the exception.
Okay.
So we've got a few things on that context, but we don't necessarily have as much of a fine grain. And then I'm calling to the base log so it can pass on to other loggers that are registered as well.
Perfect.
And so this is from the global logger. This is a generic exception, et cetera. So that's what that does. Then our text handler, this is the one that comes in and does that very confusing payment required.
Right.
So I'm saying if there's an error inside of this application that you don't know what to do with, just ask for money. I mean, that's just, that's the way we're going to deal with it.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. Yep.
And so all of these are set up with the exception, see, we're talking about exceptions, so I'm going to say with the exception of the ones that are attributes on actions, all of these are set up in the web API configuration. So here is an example of me using a filter globally within the application. So that's a filter that I could apply to an action or a controller. When I drop it in here, it is global to the application.
Okay.
Not to be confused with my one exception handler. Notice I can't add that service. I have to replace what's there with my exception handler. So I'm telling it, this is the service I'm replacing, and I'm passing it my text handler. In this case, I'm adding an exception logger, so I could add multiples of these for the logger instance.
Perfect. Okay.
But in this configuration, that's how we stand that up. And hopefully, the differences that you'll see are filters are contextual and usually deal with exceptions within an action, whereas your global handlers are going to be A, logging, which is always a good thing to just tackle at a global level. And then B, those exceptions that you can't catch within an action because it's farther up the pipeline.
Perfect.
And with that, I believe we call that a wrap for validation and errors.
That sounds perfect. I just want to close all of that off real quickly, just by mentioning that this is really one of those scenarios where, you know, there's a friend of mine that likes to say, we're not launching rockets here. And the point that he's making when he says that is that whatever it is you're trying to do, chances are somebody else has already done it. And I think error logging is a perfect example of that. A couple of people have mentioned different logging apps in the Q&A window. But what I would say is, you know, definitely go check out CodePlex, go check out GitHub, that there's a lot of projects that are out there that will centralize logging for you. And quite often, it's just simply, you know, enable it with one little switch. Maybe you have to update a config file, and then it just works, which is really nice. In any event, what do you say we go ahead and take a 10-minute break, and then we'll come on back, and we'll take a look at how we can implement security. So we'll see you guys in 10.
Sounds good.